I'm Zen. Lois. Center your chi. Harness your energy. Let the Adderall work. Focus. No prison. Go. See the light. Calm yourself. You are water. You flow like water. Life throws you situations and you adapt around them. Like flowing water.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Injection, fellas.
Oh! Oh! Sounds like suicide.
Stick anything into the fog, y'all. Make it look like a ghost. But tonight, let's not become tragedies. We are not funeral homes with propane tanks in our windows looking like cemeteries. Cemeteries are just the Earth's way of not letting go. Let go. Tonight, poets, let's turn our wrists so far backwards the razor blades and our pencil tips can't get a good angle on all that beauty inside. Step into this with your airplane parts. Move forward and repeat after me with your heart.
Repeat after me with your heart.
I no longer need you to fuck me as hard as I hated myself. Make love to me. Like you know I am better than the worst thing I ever did. Go slow. I'm new to this, but I have seen nearly every city from a rooftop without jumping. I have realized that the moon did not have to be full for us to love it, that we are not tragedies stranded here beneath it, that if our hearts really broke every time we fell from love, I'd be able to offer you confetti by now. But hearts don't break, y'all. They bruise and get better. We were never tragedies. We were emergencies. You call 911. Tell them I'm having a fantastic time.
Tell them I'm having a fantastic time.
Go on. We did it.
Why don't you live so God can use you any way, glory time? Why don't you live so God can use you any way, glory time?
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
And because I wanted to tell her story quietly and calmly with plenty of room to move, we will devote the rest of the program to my next guest, Janet Karpinski. And one of the reasons I want to do it is because I've long felt that she was, as I said earlier, pretty much the Bush administration's sacrificial lamb and allowed them to deflect a lot of criticism from up the chain of command. I'm sure that many of you will be familiar with Janice in her role as the former commander in charge of rebuilding the civilian prison system in post-Saddam Iraq, including, yes, the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. She was, and cop this, a brigadier general in the US Army Reserve. She was the first female general ever to command troops in a combat zone. And she had, by any measure, a pretty brilliant, I think, 25-year career. And until those photos revealing prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib, she was still in her ascendancy. But that scandal ruined her career. But really only her career, because Janice Karpinski is the highest-ranking officer so far to be sanctioned for the mistreatment of prisoners. And she joins me now on the phone from her home in South Carolina. Welcome to our little wireless program.
It's so wonderful to be with you. Thank you very much.
Janice, I want, first of all, when I look at the cover shot, I realize that we all know your face very well. You know, as a result of this unfortunate sequence of events, you've become internationally known. I guess you would have preferred another road to fame.
I like to say that I was a stealth operator prior to Abu Ghraib photographs being released around the world. So being thrust into the spotlight was something actually that I was very unfamiliar with and tried to avoid.
But you're now weighing in with your book, aren't you? Because you think that you think you've been hard done by.
Yes, and not only that, but I am convinced more than ever, that not only me, but the soldiers, three of the seven soldiers that the president tagged as bad apples out of control on the night shift, three of them are still serving prison sentences. And I'm very quick to tell people I don't excuse their behavior, but there's many, many people who should be sharing those cells with them.
The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has released a report into interrogation techniques used by the CIA in the years after the 9/11 attacks.
It finds that coercive interrogation techniques did not produce the vital, otherwise unavailable intelligence the CIA has claimed.
According to the Senate, the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, which were often used on Al-Qaeda terrorism suspects, are thought to be far more brutal than they let on to U.S. policymakers and the public. The report said the program, which happened while George W. Bush was in power, involved abuse, sexual threats, mock executions, and in some cases, even death. The Senate only released a summary of their five-year review, which looked at more than 6 million pages of CIA reports. They found four key points, which were: the agency's techniques were not effective, the CIA provided inaccurate information about how the program was run, the management was flawed, and the CIA were much harsher than they said they were to politicians and the public. So what did they do? Well, the report found that a detainee who was held semi-naked and chained to a concrete floor died from suspected hypothermia. Some detainees were found to be wrongfully held for months in custody, even after the CIA determined that they shouldn't have been. Sleep deprivation techniques were commonly used, keeping detainees awake for up to 180 hours at a time, usually standing in painful stress positions with their hands shackled above their heads. Detainees were sometimes told to believe they would never leave custody alive, and some were kept in solitude with loud noises or music constantly playing. The report even suggested that waterboarding took place in different detention centres. Releasing this report could be the most damaging moment in the history of the CIA, but President Barack Obama supports making the document public and bans so-called enhanced interrogation techniques soon after becoming president in 2009.
ACLU, the head of the national ACLU, has just published this op-ed in the New York Times tonight. It's going to be in tomorrow morning's paper. It calls for President... Do we have a picture of the op-ed there? I can hold it up for you if we don't have a picture of it. This op-ed, there we go. The op-ed calls for President Obama to issue a pardon to former President George W. Bush and former Vice President Dick Cheney and other senior Bush administration officials for overseeing torture as a U.S. policy for years. Quote, the spectacle of the president's granting pardons to torturers still makes my stomach turn, he said, but doing so may be the only way to ensure that the American government never tortures again. Pardons would make clear that crimes were committed.
I can tell them we waterboarded three people. Back last one was waterboarded in 2003. Three people.
Yeah.
And there is a debate.
The doctor in the room.
On whether
Do
that is
ISIS
actionable intelligence or not.
Has a doctor in the room when they decapitate people with a knife?
You just said we're a beacon, a moral beacon.
So, in the history of this country, I think months after 9/11. There were three people who we thought knew about imminent attacks, and we did whatever we had to do. And I pray to God that till the end of time, we do whatever we have to do to find out what's happening. And the notion that this somehow makes America less great is asinine and dangerous. And I swear to God, I have never felt more frustrated with this White House's inability to speak clearly than I was yesterday when John Carl was pushing Josh Earnest to say whether Obama found the information gleaned helpful in killing bin Laden. But you watch that exchange with John Carl and Earnest, and that's what this is about. Does it help us kill people who want to kill us? regardless of what we do. But the notion that what we do affects the behavior of terrorists is a lie. It's a lie perpetrated by political correctness and by liberals, and it's dangerous.
That's just not true. That's not true.
That's how I feel. You don't have to win me over, and I don't have to win you over, but that's how I feel. And I respect the way you feel.
But here's the problem.
I have long believed some of these practices amounted to torture, as a reasonable person would define it, especially, but not only, the practice of waterboarding, which is a mock execution and an exquisite form of torture. Its use was shameful and unnecessary, and contrary to assertions made by some of its defenders, and as the committee's report makes clear, it produced little useful intelligence to help us track down the perpetrators of 9/11 or prevent new attacks and atrocities. I know from personal experience that the abuse of prisoners will produce more bad than good intelligence. I know that victims of torture will offer intentionally misleading information if they think their captors will believe it. I know they will say whatever their torturers want them to say if they believe it will stop their suffering. Most of all, I know the use of torture compromises that which most distinguishes us from our enemies. Our belief that all people, even captured enemies, possess basic human rights which are protected by international conventions the United States not only joined, but for the most part, author. I know, too, that bad things happen in war. I know in war, good people can feel obliged for good reasons to do things they would normally object to and recoil from. I understand the reasons that govern the decision to resort to these interrogation methods. And I know that those who approve them and those who use them were dedicated to securing justice for the victims of terrorist attacks and to protect Americans from further harm. I know their responsibilities were grave and urgent, and the strain of their duty was onerous. I respect their dedication and appreciate their dilemma, but I dispute wholeheartedly that it was right for them to use these methods, which this report makes clear were neither in the best interests of justice, nor our security, nor the ideals we have sacrificed so much blood and treasure to defend.
Justin Kirk from Inanimate Sensuation. No relation, closely assured. No conversation, no social contagion. Bother me, wanna be comrade in truth. See if I remain inanimate, a loop. Skip counterfeit, like no can do. This my final vibrate higher than you. This I represent a metaphor. Soup, risk, one of you. All you want, wanna ride while I ain't got room. Stress, what we can trip. You don't make shit tighter. You stand. Then fucking
The Senate torture report finally came out this week, and predictably, the corporate media is feigning shock that the government institutionalized and codified a global torture program. It's also having a field day pretending like it cares about torture. Oh, I'm sorry, enhanced interrogation techniques. Oh, I'm sorry, EITs. So, 12 years later, obviously the debate is about how the perpetrator should be held accountable, right? Actually, in order not to appear biased against one of the greatest crimes a government can possibly commit, networks are making sure to provide more than enough time to the actual torture architects to tell their side of the story.
We did exactly what needed to be done in order to catch those who were guilty on 9/11 and to prevent a further attack. And we were successful on both parts.
This report says it was not successful.
The report's full of crap.
In times in which you are threatened, in circumstances of that sort, the rules can be somewhat different under American constitutional law.
We're dealing with animals. We're dealing with groups of people who behead, blow up, exterminate people.
So we too should be animals?
The way you defeat an animal, Carol, oftentimes is to act like one.
I think we were perfectly justified in doing it, and I'd do it again in a minute.
I have absolutely no doubt that Darth Chaney would torture someone again in a heartbeat for no reason, considering the fact that zero actionable intelligence was gleaned from these horrific tactics. But facts aren't stopping the masterminds of the torture program from gallivanting around the MSM explaining why torture worked. And Democrats are just trying to tarnish the GOP's wonderful reputation. And since when does torture have another side? This is 2014. Torture was banned internationally under the UN Convention Against Torture, signed by Reagan in 1984, under which Article 2 states, no exceptional circumstance whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification. It goes on to say under Article 3 that an order from a superior officer or public authority may not be invoked as a justification. Wow, Reagan was so ahead of his time. But according to torturers, it's not like they were pulling fingernails out of anything. Come on, guys, what's the harm in simulated drowning? Or tactics, which the report revealed encompassed everything from rectal feeding to rape threats. Come on, guys, they're just threats. And while threats of rape should never be downplayed, I can't help but wonder where the outrage was when we found out that prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib were actually raped. One Gitmo prisoner claimed sexual abuse was rampant. At Abu Ghraib, well, there are even photos of rape. Yes, photos. Because apparently the sociopathic guards there wanted to look back and reminisce about torture at their 20-year reunion. Unfortunately, those photos, along with 2,000 others, are being withheld by the Obama cabinet. Gee, I wonder why. Another point that the media is rightfully honing in on is the fact that one prisoner in a dungeon-like torture facility dubbed Cobalt died from hypothermia on a cold, damp floor. But unfortunately, the amount of people that have died in CIA custody post 9/11 is innumerable. Glenn Greenwald pointed out back in 2009 that the interrogation and detention regime implemented by the U.S. resulted in the deaths of over 100 detainees in U.S. custody, at least. Look, anyone who's been paying attention knows that this small summary doesn't tell us a sliver of the dark and disturbing truth. This report has turned into a partisan blame game and is nothing more than a whitewashed, sanitized version of reality. It's good that people are paying attention to this issue again. But the war criminals that ordered and executed the torture, until they're standing on the trial at The Hague, spare me the faux outrage.
Broke
there's a social code. So walk straight down the middle now and do what we're told. Walk straight down the middle now and do what we're told. Who is the who telling who what to do? Who is the who telling who what to do? Who is the who telling who what to do? Tell me who, tell me who, tell me who. Said it didn't feel so good to never be fulfilled. Forever stressed out and impatient, always saying just over the next hill. Always saying just over the next hill. Freedom a gift that we only give to the ones that say I love you. Who is the who telling who what to do? Who is the who telling who what to do? Who is the who telling who what to do? Tell me who, tell me who, tell me who. Now one and April are two different things. One is desire and the other is the means. Like I wanna hold you and see you and feel you in my dreams. But that's not possible. Something simply will not let me.
From Constitution Hall in Washington, the National Broadcasting Company brings you a special broadcast of the presentation of Hubbard Gold Medals to the two heroes of the recent National Geographic Society United States Army Air Corps Stratosphere Flight. Captain Albert W. Stevens and Captain Orville A. Anderson. The Hubbard Medal, to be presented tonight, is one of the most coveted honor awards in the world, with a list of only 10 recipients. And now it's our pleasure to introduce Dr. Gilbert Grosvenor, President of the National Geographic Society.
Members and friends of the National Geographic Society, General John J. Pershing, beloved by all Americans, is the fifth soldier in the history of our country to achieve the exalted rank of General of the Armies of the United States. General Pershing has honored and aided the National Geographic Society for many years as an active and inspiring member of its Board of Trustees. Tonight he has consented to speak in his capacity as trustee of the Society. I have the honor to present General Pershing.
President Grosvenor, members and guests of the National Geographic Society. Within the past year, our society has sponsored or participated in a series of extraordinary expeditions which have added important facts to world geography and altered the map of two continents. The gallant Admiral Richard E. Byrd, whose second expedition to South Polar regions was supported by a substantial grant from the Society, returned recently with proof that the vast Antarctic land is a single continent. The Society's Yukon expedition, under the leadership of the youthful Bradford Washburn, achieved the first crossing of the mighty St. Elias Range, discovered new glaciers and peaks, named two of the latter for King George and Queen Mary in honor of their silver jubilee, and mapped 2,000 square miles of territory. We are gathered tonight to honor two men who have climbed to the greatest height yet reached above sea level and have brought back to Earth an amazing collection of scientific data from this remarkable height. It is for me a personal pleasure to take part in this ceremony because the Air Corps of the United States was joint sponsor of the expedition, and because this memorable ascent was made on Armistice Day, a memorable anniversary in our history. The studies of this expedition in many scientific fields, such as those bearing upon weather prediction, cosmic ray research, upon farming problems and radio transmission, illustrate the diverse activities of the National Geographic Society and the resourcefulness and enterprise of our peacetime army. It is gratifying to recall that the stratosphere expedition of November 11th is only one of a number of assaults on the battlefront of science in which the Army and the Society have been allies. In this instance, the Army has had representatives worthy of its finest traditions in the men who commanded and piloted the stratosphere balloon, Captain Albert W. Stevens and Captain Orville A. Anderson. In both airplanes and balloons, as Chief Photographic Officer of the 1st Army of the American Expeditionary Forces, Captain Stevens, as an observer and photographer, secured valuable information of the enemy and his movements, and by persistent laboratory work, improved military photography. He continued, after the armistice, to perfect the art of map-making from an aerial photograph. At the headquarters of the National Geographic Society hang two of the world's most remarkable photographs made by Captain Stevens. One is the first photograph taken showing laterally the curvature of the Earth. The other is an aerial photograph showing the advancing shadow of the moon on the Earth during a total eclipse of the sun.
I'm wildin' on them.
Signs of water currents and sediments can be seen in these images released by NASA. The new findings combine more than 2 years of information collected by NASA's Curiosity rover since its landing inside the Gale crater in August 2012. This interpretation of Curiosity's finds suggests that ancient Mars maintained a climate that could have produced long-lasting lakes on the Red Planet. Scientists discovered stacks of rocks containing water-deposited sediments inclined towards the crater's center, which now has a 3-mile mound called Mount Sharp. The scenario suggests that water could have filled much of the 96-mile-wide Gale crater 3.5 billion years ago, and that Mount Sharp could have been formed by repeated cycles of sediment build-up and erosion. NASA believes that if their theory for Mount Sharp holds up, it challenges the notion that warm and wet conditions were transient, local, or only underground on Mars. The findings also provide further support for the view that ancient Mars could have sustained life as we know it on Earth. After 9 years and a journey of 4.8 billion kilometres, a NASA probe woke up from hibernation on Saturday to begin taking a closer look at Pluto. The New Horizons probe came out of hibernation and transmitted a message to Earth. It awoke at 3 p.m. but is so far away that radio signals travelling at the speed of light take 4 hours and 25 minutes to reach Earth, so control teams didn't receive the confirmation until about 9:30 p.m. The spacecraft captured this view of the giant planet Neptune and its moon Triton in July from a distance of about 2.4 billion miles. New Horizons was launched in January 2006 and was in hibernation for 1,873 days, which is about two-thirds of its journey. Its hibernation period was to preserve the craft's electric power and minimize resources needed to monitor it. The probe aims to study Pluto, which is an icy body with several moons near the outer reaches of our solar system. Data on Pluto's topography and its largest moon Charon will be collected, giving astronomers an up-close look at the surfaces that are difficult to see from Earth.
corner like the cold crush. Had smokers lining up the block like a gold rush. Saying live fast and die young is what they told us. The way that they mold us, perfect way they showed us how to get money. Ugh, bitches off this nose dust. Showed me how to burn the block down before it slows up. Before the window of opportunity closed up.
Sounds like suicide.
Burn the block apart.
In 2003, researchers did the measurements and found that Kansas is, in fact, literally flatter than a pancake. Of course, the Earth is not flat, the Earth is round. Otherwise, travelers would be falling off the edge all the time. Right? Wrong. If the Earth was not a ball shape, but was instead a flat disk, like this plate, well, with the right density and thickness, living in the middle could feel pretty normal. But as you moved toward the edge, gravity on a disk Earth would slightly skew, pushing at a greater and greater angle back toward the center. My friend Nick from Yeti Dynamics put together this great simulation. The person and buildings obviously aren't to scale, but check out how such increasingly diagonal gravity would work. Although this is a flat disk, it would feel, to a runner headed toward the edge, like they were fighting to climb up a steeper and steeper hill. The building foundations behind the runner reflect how you would have to build structures closer and closer to the edge so that people living in them always felt like down was at right angles to the floor, the way we feel it on our big round Earth. Now, as you approach the edge, things would get scary. Remember, this is a flat Earth, but it would feel like a sheer drop-off. What's really cool is that contrary to the don't fall off the edge fear, on a flat world, because of gravity, the scary risk would actually be falling away from the edge and rolling all the way back to the center. Once you stepped over the edge, instead of falling off into space, you'd be able to relax. It would be a nice, level place. This model, of course, neglects the fact that such a planet shape would be impossible. Anything as massive as the Earth, shaped like a flat disk, would, under its own gravity, naturally collapse back into a ball. This is why in outer space, everything more than a few hundred miles in diameter is round. Or so we've been told. What if gravity isn't real? What if the Earth is in fact flat and science has been wrong all along? It's a misconception that Christopher Columbus discovered that the Earth is round. Virtually every scholar and major religion in the West accepted Earth's rotundity since at least the time of the ancient Greeks, who, for instance, had noticed that boats disappear bottom first when sailing away, and as you walk north and south, stars pop into and out of view. The misconception that only a few hundred years ago lots and lots of people believed the Earth was flat likely began in the modern era as a sort of insult, a, well, your people recently thought the Earth was flat, so why should we believe you now? The smear was repeated and published so often it became accepted as historical fact. Flat earther became synonymous with anti-science. It might seem flat over short distances, but over longer ones, well, the Earth is pretty darn curvy. The Verrazano Narrows Bridge connecting Staten Island and Brooklyn had to be designed with Earth's roundness in mind. Its two towers, separated by 1,300 meters and perfectly vertical, are nonetheless 41 millimeters further apart at the top than at the bottom because of Earth's curvature. In the 3rd century BC, Eratosthenes measured the differences between shadows cast by poles in Syene and Alexandria to calculate, more than 2,000 years before rockets and space travel, the circumference of the entire globular Earth, with, for the time, impressive accuracy. Word got around that the Earth was a round shape after that. But in 1906, Wilbur Glenn Vallava became head of a slightly bizarre religious sect that pretty much ran the city of Zion, Illinois. Vallava believed that the Earth was actually flat, and he enforced flat Earth teachings in schools in Zion. He also enforced that belief on really anyone who entered the city. Vallava believed not only that the Earth was flat, but that the Sun was only a few thousand miles away from Earth, not 93 million. He also believed that the Sun was only 32 miles across, not 860,000. He sounds crazy. Or does he? You see, the same phenomenon Eratosthenes measured could be explained by a flat Earth if the Sun were only a few thousand miles away and 32 miles across. The math would work out the same. Today, with the power of the internet, modern-day flat earthers have picked up where Vallava left off. They have quite good explanations for any evidence you throw at them that the Earth is round. Circumnavigation is really just a flat circle path. The round shadow Earth casts on the moon during a lunar eclipse could also be made by a flat disk. Time zones are caused by a spotlight sun. And remember how gravity would be totally different on a disk-shaped planet? Well, they argue that gravity as we know it simply doesn't exist. The flat disk of Earth is merely accelerating up at 9.8 meters per second. As for all of the photos and video evidence we now have that the Earth is round thanks to space exploration, well, all of that material is completely fabricated. A hoax perpetrated by Big Globe. Space agencies, airlines, globe manufacturers, they are reaping the rewards of our ignorant belief that the Earth is actually round. They know, of course, that it's flat, and they're hiding that truth from us. Is it merely a coincidence that the logo used by the Flat Earth Society is a projection of Earth centered on the North Pole and also happens to be the projection used by the United Nations? Are these people for real? Probably not most of them, but this is the crux of Poe's Law, an adage that states that at their extremes, parody of extremism and sincere extremism are difficult to distinguish. Although clever, flat earth theories are predominantly ad hoc explanations, excuses made up on the spot that only address one issue and don't fit all the evidence. Science, of course, rejects a theory if a better one fits more of our observations, but why the egotistical obsession with our observations? A cosmic ray particle could use the very same scientific method we use and conclude that the Earth was in fact flat. You see, at speeds near the speed of light, time slows down and lengths contract. One way we know this is that unstable muons created in the upper atmosphere by the collision of cosmic rays with the atmosphere should mostly decay before reaching Earth's surface. But yet, we detect a lot of them down here. because their crazy fast speed literally means that from our perspective, their physics runs according to a slower clock. And to them, the distance they have to cover to the surface during their short lives is, from their perspective, much, much shorter than it appears to us. If you were a cosmic ray proton traveling at 99.999999999991% the speed of light, Earth would appear to be only 17 meters thick in the direction you traveled. So Earth is flat to them, but round to us. It is ball-shaped to some observers and flat to others. There doesn't appear to be a single most correctest in all circumstances answer. Susan Hack compares knowledge to a crossword puzzle. New answers interweave with old ones. They all reinforce one another. The clues are the questions we ask, and the way the answers fall into a predetermined grid, well, that's our confidence that we're on the right track. But that doesn't mean that one day there will be a finished puzzle, a complete answer. Recall the New York Times famous 1996 crossword puzzle that came out the day before the US election between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole. The clue for 39 across was pretty crazy. You seemed to need to be able to tell the future to answer it correctly. It simply said, lead story in tomorrow's newspaper, blank elected. Well, that blank could be Clinton or Bob Dole. And who's to say which one until tomorrow? There's no way to know. But as it turned out, the answer was Clinton or Bob Dole. No matter which you wrote in, all the other clues fit. For instance, a black Halloween animal could either be a cat or a bat. Our knowledge about the outside world might be the same. A puzzle with no answer key, just the reassurance that the answers we think we know fit together, so they're probably correct. Though there's always the possibility that the answer to one clue or all of them will fundamentally not have a single definite satisfying answer. The puzzle may be playable forever. I like what Richard Feynman says about this. Some people say, how can you live without knowing? I do not know what they mean. I always live without knowing. That is easy. How you get to know is what I want to know. You know?
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want? GoFindTheOthers.com.
Is that not the greatest suicide ever? Yeah. That's the point I was making.